Coming up on this week's book show, Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman is one of the most recognizable and trusted voices on economics and policy today. His new book, Arguing with Zombies, Economics, Politics, and the Fight for a Better Future, explaining the complexities of healthcare, housing bubbles, tax reform, and Social Security. Paul Krugman on this week's book show. This interview was recorded on March 7th. Much has happened since then. Any number of specifics could be outdated.
Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. This is an off-the-shelf edition of the Book Show in partnership with Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center, Vermont, and recorded before a live audience. Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman is one of the most recognizable and trusted voices on economics and policy today. Through a regular column in the New York Times, a popular blog, and best-selling books, he looks to communicate the basic economics that we need to understand public policy. His new book is Arguing with Zombies, Economics, Politics, and the Fight for a Better Future. Drawn mainly from his Times column, it covers a wide range of issues organized thematically and framed in the context of a wider debate, explaining the complexities of healthcare, housing bubbles, tax reform, and Social Security, just to name a few. Paul Krugman is a recipient of the 2008 Nobel Prize in Economics. He has been a columnist at the New York Times for 20 years and a distinguished professor at City University of New York. The new book is Arguing with Zombies. It is a great pleasure to welcome Paul Krugman to this week's book show. You make this point. Anyone who has read you, I think, knows this, but let's start here. What do you consider the zombies to be?
Okay, so the zombies are not people. I mean, there may be some out there, but the zombie ideas, it's a phrase I picked up from a paper I read a long time ago, but that immediately caught my eye because it's something I encounter all the time. Many of the economic arguments that we have, not just economics, but certainly in economics, they never seem to be settled, even though they should be settled, even after an idea has been clearly proved wrong by events, even though, you know, it should be dead, it just keeps on going, just keeps shambling along, eating people's brains. And it turns out that these zombie ideas, these unkillable, clearly wrong ideas, are actually most of what we argue about in public affairs, that there are some serious good faith debates, there are things on which people have who are actually trying to get it right can honestly disagree, but those are actually politically unimportant. All of the important ones are people who are trying to actually pay attention to the facts versus zombie ideas.
Is it possible to kill the zombie, or will it always just be an argument with that zombie?
Oh, I don't think you can ever kill these things. I mean, that's been my experience, that no matter how absurd something is, no matter how many times it's been proved wrong, something like tax cuts pay for themselves. We've tried that, right, many, many, many times. You know, we've done the experiment. We've done the experiment nationally under various presidents. We've done it in many states, and it has never worked. And yet, around came the 2017 tax cut, and essentially every Republican senator said, I believe this tax cut will pay for itself. So you never managed to kill them, but maybe you can contain. Actually, all these things seem more relevant now.
Yes.
You can contain the epidemic by getting out the fact that this is a zombie. Again, talking to people who might not understand that this is not a real argument, that this is not a good faith argument.
One of the things that I found just fascinating in the book is that if you look, this is a collection of columns. The oldest one dates back to, what, 92?
Yeah, the oldest thing there is an essay from 1992 before I was at the Times.
So these go back. And yet, with all of the changes, and another way of saying of arguing with zombies is that we don't always learn from our mistakes, right?
I mean, preface, what do you mean, we white men? But an important part of the political spectrum doesn't learn from mistakes. I try to learn from my mistakes, but lots of people don't. That's right. The oldest essay in the book is something I wrote for the American Prospect in 1992 about people trying to deny that rising inequality was an issue in America. And I went through a series of really bad arguments that people make trying to deny the fact of rapidly rising inequality. And the piece, for the most part, reads as if it could have been written today, because all of those arguments are still out there, still being made. I think the point you were getting at is that although these are, most of the essays are over the past 15 years, some going back even further, they don't date that much because we are dealing with zombies, and the zombies just keep shambling along.
So there is what it makes sense economically, and then perhaps what makes sense politically, and those don't always or ever meet.
Well, you gotta be a little careful. I mean, it's not so much, we make a mistake and we're too unfair to the general public if we think that it's public ignorance that sustains the zombies. Mostly it's not. Most of the zombie ideas are not because people are too uninformed or too stupid to get it. Most of them are kept alive because there are essentially people who are paid to keep them alive. Not all. There are some zombie ideas that are not just people who are essentially serving the interests of special interest groups. But most of them are. Mostly something like, you know, tax cuts for the rich are miraculous in their effect. Why does that persist despite overwhelming evidence that's not true? Well, consider the interests and consider who funds right-wing think tanks and who provides campaign contributions. And that's what keeps these things alive.
Given what has been going on in this country, let's just say in the last 2 weeks, is this a good time for you to be out talking about these issues?
Well, I mean, for sure, the general election is going to be, to the extent that it's about issues at all, it'll be zombies on one side and at least reasonable arguments on the other. So hopefully that it will be a good time. I hope this is a time when part of the choice to release this book was partly because I thought it would be relevant for this year's election. Now in terms of is it a great time to be publishing a book like this? There are an awful lot of things going on that are not particularly on this theme. And when I look at what are people are reading at the Times, because we now, of course, if you're in the business, you obsessively follow the most popular list to see whether you've resonated. And by and large, the most popular list is dominated with articles about how to boil a perfect egg and grilling with mayonnaise. A lot of people really just want to escape because the things are so awful. But still, I think there is a chord here.
You tweeted a bleak thought. I often tell people not to worry too much about disasters in advanced countries because such countries are incredibly resilient. They have wealth, they have competent civil services. For example, I've never bought into the disaster scenarios for Brexit. In other words, is Trump's America still an advanced country as we normally imagine it? We have huge reserves of expertise and talent to deal with crises, but these people are disdained and distrusted. It's not clear whether the message that the coronavirus is a real problem, not a PR issue, has made it through. Albany gets it, Sacramento gets it, the White House, for the first time, I'm getting seriously scared.
So Britain has left the European Union, which is a mistake. It'll make Britain poorer. It'll hamper their industry. But there have been some of the anti-Brexit people have warned about real disaster scenarios where you have 150-mile-long traffic jams at Dover and Calais, and supplies of medicine run out and everything in it. And I've been saying, although that's theoretically possible because you're introducing a border where there was none, in fact, Britain is an advanced country. The civil service knows what to do. They will find workarounds. They'll manage to avoid the worst because we know these are advanced countries deal with natural disasters. They deal with calamities. We just have enormous capacity. But under current leadership in the United States right now, we have the expertise, we have the people, we have the bureaucratic capacity. But just reading reports today that people at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, when journalists have said, well, I probably shouldn't shake hands with you because we coronavirus, and I said, oh, I don't believe that. The CDC is just part of the deep state. They're just trying to undermine Trump. So we're in that kind of world where although we have all of the capacity to respond to this or any other crisis, all the reasons why America actually is great, but we have leadership that doesn't want to hear about it and it actively punishes people for talking sense.
So great. So a two-part question. One is, what does that mean for our current economic situation of what we all see, what is happening, and is there any way to forecast what is coming? And the second part of this large question is that you have a president who is largely running on the economy. And the great, quote unquote, economy that he created or inherited or however it's interpreted.
I've been saying for a while now that the important thing, until just maybe now, if people ask me what's going to cause the next economic crisis in the United States, I would say, I don't know. There wasn't anything obvious on the horizon. The housing bubble of the mid-2000s, that was obvious, I thought. And it was obvious it was going to be nasty when it burst, although I didn't realize how nasty it was going to be. But there wasn't anything comparable on the scale, so I didn't know where the next bump in the road was coming from. But what was obvious, has been obvious all along, is that we don't know where the next bump was, but we do know that the shock absorbers are shot. The normal response, so now let's get a little wonkish here. The normal response, the first line of defense, the aspirin you take when something goes wrong with the economy is that the Federal Reserve, which is still a haven of technocratic competence, for the moment anyway, cuts interest rates. But we start with a situation where interest rates are already very low. The Fed just cut a few days ago. Before that, the rates that the Fed effectively controls were about 1.5%. And in an average recession, the Fed has cut interest rates by 5 percentage points. So it basically had only about 30% as much ammunition as it uses normally to deal with a recession. And that's and of course, the rest of the advanced world is in even worse shape. Interest rates are actually negative in Europe and Japan. So the first line of defense is, or the shock absorber for normal stuff, wasn't there. We have a world economy which is, for the moment, relatively close to full employment, but only thanks to an ultra-low interest rate regime, so no real room to cut. So if anything bad happens, where there's no easy response, it requires actually something more sophisticated, requires real leadership from Washington, so good luck with that. And so even a moderately bad shock, the kind of thing that in the 1990s the Fed could have dealt with without ever requiring the politicians really step in at all, is now a really serious problem. And then along comes this thing, and I'm no epidemiologist, but it's clear that this is actually really serious, and the economic consequences are looking quite serious. It's partly disrupting global supply chains and all of that. So once you start to look into it, the number of things that depend upon at least some components shipped from China is huge. But even beyond that, when people stop traveling, stop going out, stop spending, you've got this major hit to the economy, which is exactly the kind of scenario that we were fearing.
You sort of see this coming down the pike for a long time then, as far as the concern about a crisis and the ability of the people in an economic charge to be able to handle it.
Now, I famously made a bad call on election night. predicting disaster, which I retracted 3 days later, saying this is the I let my political dismay override my economics. And I said, in the short term, actually, what's probably going to happen is that Trump is going to run bigger budget deficits, which is actually going to give the economy a bit of a boost, at least initially. But my concern right from the beginning was that you were bringing in people who have a, look, I've made a number of bad calls over the course of my life. Larry Kudlow, who is effectively the administration's chief economist, he's somebody who, I make a distinction in the book, in Arguing with Zombies, between conservative professional economists, of whom there are many, and many of whom I respect, and professional conservative economists, which is something quite different. And Kudlow is a professional conservative economist, and he has an absolutely unbroken track record. He's never been right about anything. And was representative. I mean, that's the kind of people they want. They don't, there's a kind of pathos to the good conservative economists. Economics is a relatively conservative profession, as it turns out. You know, where I work now is an interdisciplinary shop with political scientists and sociologists, and you know, economists are a whole lot more conservative on average than sociologists. But the smart conservative economists are not wanted. There are none of them in the Trump administration. There are none of them advising Republicans in Congress, because they only want the hacks. They only want the people who are essentially hired guns, propagandists, pushing the zombie ideas. And so those are the people who are now in charge of managing any response that we have to an economic crisis.
Paul Krugman is our guest. The name of the new book is Arguing with Zombies. You wrote this week in response to Super Tuesday about Joe Biden and looking at the Joe Biden of old and saying that you seemed optimistic.
Well, you know, it's a peculiar rule. The New York Times columnists are not allowed to do explicit political endorsements. Because the reason is, if you do, then somebody will say the New York Times says vote for Joe Smith, when it was actually just some columnist who did it. So I can imply, although I guess in principle you don't even know which party I favor, but clearly Elizabeth Warren was my kind of
right
person. Smart, really understood the issues, very progressive, also probably just too much like me. Aside from the sexism thing, which I think is the dominant issue, also probably just too much, you know, a college professor. And Joe Biden clearly does not have a history of being really strongly progressive, but he's, first of all, huge difference between him and Trump. And second, he has moved with the party. And the Democratic Party is much more of a clearly, what the Europeans would call a social democratic party, a party that favors, you know, market economy, but with a strong social safety net and taxes on the wealthy and regulation of business than it used to be. And Joe Biden has moved with it. We just had the analysis of Joe Biden's tax plan, and it's hitting the rich pretty hard. So I think that in terms of policy positions, whatever his inclinations might be, Biden is likely, if he makes it to the White House, to be a lot more progressive than, you know, some people might imagine. And I've been saying for a while, actually, that in some ways it doesn't matter which of the Democrats gets the nomination, that as long as he or she wins. That any Democrat, if it still could be Bernie Sanders, very unlikely now, but it still could be Bernie Sanders, and if he makes it to the White House, he'll come in with this vastly ambitious agenda, discover within about 48 hours that he can't get that through Congress, and end up basically vastly enhancing Obamacare and raising taxes considerably, but not enormously, on the rich. Whereas if Joe Biden becomes president, he'll try to compromise with Republicans and in 48 hours discover that he can't do that. And what he'll end up doing is vastly enhancing Obamacare and significantly raising taxes on the rich. So the actual policy outcome is probably going to be about the same.
From here to there, as far as the race between we'll put Tulsi Gabbard aside just
right
for a moment, or beyond, and ask, then what does that mean for people who are future voters throughout this country looking at Bernie Sanders? What should they, I mean, you just alluded to it, but what should they make of his economic plan?
See, I think that Bernie Sanders, I don't really have big problems with his economic plans. First of all, I don't think they would happen. But even if they did, I actually don't worry. I mean, people who are worried that wealth taxes are going to destroy the economy, the idea that people are going to stop being entrepreneurs because they fear that they will be taxed on their second $50 million is just not plausible. And so the idea that, so I'm not worried about the plans at all.
I want to make a couple, just ask you a couple of things about the book specifically before our time ends. That is, as I mentioned in the introduction, you look at these various topics. The two that really stand out, of course, are inequality and climate change.
Yeah.
And so talk to us about the economics of climate change. I mean, obviously, if we're not here, then the economy's kind of screwed. But beyond that, of how we look at it from now till then, and also what we should look for as a plan to move it ahead, to make progress in the situation.
Actually, the climate change is an issue where there are multiple zombies out there. One of them is the zombie idea that is not happening, that it's all a hoax, and which is a view that is held by 3% or less of scientists and 73% of Republican senators, and that's a it's a pretty it does a lot of damage. But then there's a second zombie, which is the idea that trying to rapidly reduce emissions and get ourselves to avoid climate catastrophe would have huge economic costs. And that's clearly, at this point, not true. It wasn't true, it didn't appear to be true even 10 years ago, 15 years ago, because economies have a lot of, give people the right incentives, and there's a lot of adjustments we can do. But now, technology is our friend. The progress in renewable energy has been incredible. At this point, the Trump administration is trying desperately to find ways to subsidize coal because coal is just not competitive with solar and wind at this point. The technology for a very low emission, not zero emission, because there are some things that are still hard to do that way, is in place. It would not require a whole lot of incentives, government investment, some kind of carbon taxes to shift us there, and the effects on GDP would be within the range of statistical noise. You really wouldn't feel the effects on growth at all. So it's actually easy, which makes it such a tragedy that we're heading for catastrophe when in fact it's not perhaps totally free, but it's actually very easy to make the move. The trouble is you need to make that point, and I do try to make that point. We also need to figure out a way to get this to happen politically. And so the whole Green New Deal thing, there's an interesting divide. A lot of economists, a lot of my colleagues, are purists. They say, well, the way to do this is to get the prices right, and so we need a carbon tax, end of story. I think that's actually wrong on the economics, even, because a lot of the things you want to do to shift to a green economy involve public investment. A lot of the progress in green technology that we've seen actually comes from the subsidies and investments that Obama made during that first stimulus plan. So governments can do a lot to promote technologies. There's a lot of building the networks that make it possible for people to make use of renewable energy. So there's a good economics role that goes well beyond just putting a price on emissions. But beyond that, if your economic plan is all spinach and no dessert, then it's going to be a hard sell, even if it, no matter how right it may be. So Green New Deal stuff, nobody knows what the Green New Deal means, which is a huge advantage. Green New Deal is meant to be, it's meant to be a package of stuff, some of it directly related to climate change, some of it maybe not so directly. It's kind of, I'm probably mixing metaphors here, but what people sometimes call Christmas tree bills in Congress, laden with gifts for lots of people. Well, you want it to be a Christmas tree. You want it to have jobs created here and investments there and all kinds of good stuff along the way, saving civilization. I'm for an eclectic approach that has lots of stuff that tries to mobilize. I mean, there are actually probably now about five times as many people employed in solar power as there are coal miners.
but we haven't managed to mobilize the politics of that reality, which already exists. This is really not a time to say, well, textbook economics says that there's this one answer, and so that's the only answer we should consider. You want to basically do everything that you can think of and try to bring as many people on board as possible.
When it comes to the issue of inequality, you make the point that, in your opinion, pretty much anything that has come out of any major policy that has come out of this administration has only increased that inequality. Yeah. So how then, moving forward in, let's say, a new administration, is that reversed in a way that is meaningful, that is something that actually can be, as you say, can get through Congress, but can also genuinely help individuals in this country?
Let's talk about what I would like that is probably beyond the realm of what we can do anytime soon here anyway. You know, Bernie Sanders once said that he thought we should be like Denmark, which I agree. Actually, a lot of us look at Denmark as kind of a model of what a modern social democratic country can look like. So if you think that technology and globalization make it require that you have this hugely unequal society, look, Denmark uses the same technology we do, faces the same global markets we do, but has vastly less inequality than we do. How do they do it? They do it actually working at both ends. They have a high taxes, somewhat taxes on the rich, but actually a lot of it is mostly that the taxes are used to provide very generous social benefits, which are strongly redistributive. And they also have much stronger bargaining power for workers, because 60% of Danish workers are union members. We are not going to get there anytime soon. We're not going to be able to have a Danish-level welfare state, because they actually have high middle-class taxes, too. People feel that it's okay because they get benefits in return, but that's probably not going to happen. And we're not going to get up to 60% unionization. But can the United States strengthen? We've had a legal and political environment that was very anti-union. We can reverse that. We can raise the minimum wage quite a ways, with all the evidence suggests, with no job losses. So we can, on the one hand, enhance the position of workers. And on the other hand, we can raise taxes on the rich quite a lot, and use that to pay for expanded social programs. Some people on the Democratic left talk down what was achieved under Obama. And it's true that it was, if your hopes were for a really radical transformation, that didn't happen. But Obama raised taxes on the rich much more than most people realize, although the rich do realize it, which is part of the... the average tax rate on the top 1% by the end of the Obama administration was almost back to where it was before Reagan. And he got 20 million Americans health insurance. And that's now a double or triple that, which is well within the realm of political possibility, I think, in the next administration. And we're actually we're making some really significant difference.
Paul Krugman's new book is Arguing with Zombies: Economics, Politics, and the Fight for a Better Future. It is published by Norton. What a great pleasure to have you join us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. This off-the-shelf edition was recorded in Manchester Center, Vermont, in partnership with Northshire Bookstore, Northshire.com. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.